all the elements are coming together as they said. Okay, very good. Well, welcome to the sixth, and I'm afraid, slides for lecture six. Oh, okay, very good. Welcome to the last section of this class on the interwar years, last session, and here's the roadmap for today. It's Hitler's Germany, architecture, propaganda, statism, Mises and Austrians after Vienna. Then we'll talk about the European allies a little bit. Go back to the Far East, where we spent a good bit of time. Then back to Europe, the outbreak of the war, and then a little bit about the Americans and the war. And then we will be done. We will be out of the interwar period because it will be wartime. And maybe we can do another set of lessons on World War II, but I think 6 weeks is too little for that one. It may have to be longer. So let's roll on, and it's a fun fact page. I know we don't have much spare time today, but I knew these things, and I just thought we'd have to say them, especially since we're going to talk about the financial impact of the Americans on the European side of things and the economic effects of the New Deal on the Japanese side of things. But I did want to get in these sort of specialized economic facts. And one is that Charles G. Dawes, he was not just a pretty face, as you see there, not just an international banker and vice president to Silent Cal Coolidge, but also a composer. He wrote Melody in A Major in 1912. Words were added in 1951, and that became the song It's All in the Game, which is, I'm sure, quite familiar to most of you. Another thing is that his compadre, Owen Young, who was actually an elitist, he went to all the elite schools, but he came from a farm someplace in the wilds of upstate New York. And Owen Young, who was Time Man of the Year for negotiating that extended Young Plan in 1929, the one that put, you know, even more Germany into thrall to the Western bankers, using the railway system as a as collateral. He was accompanied in those negotiations by J.P. Morgan Jr. and Morgan partner Thomas Lamont, father of Corliss Lamont, et cetera, et cetera. And Owen won Time of the Year Man for that. Time Man of the Year for that. Also, it's interesting that Owen, like Charles V, retired early at the height of his powers and went back to, not to a monastery as Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire did, but rather to a pig farm, and continued his life, got out of the game of high international banking, and went back home. Okay, so those are fun facts for the day, and that's the last one we'll have today, so I thought I would kind of introduce that here. So let's talk about Hitler's Germany for the next little while, and I'd like to say this, that the National Socialists talk all the time about renewal, and if you think about it, all of these movements between the wars, all of these regimes that attempted to be a third way, not liberalism, not monarch, not conservatism, but a third way, they all talked about renewal. Fascist, quasi-fascist, non-fascist, they all talk about some kind of renewal of the resources of the nation. And this renewal would all come at the, you know, with the forces of the state at the disposal of the nation. The National Socialist renewal was quite explicitly against decadence. You remember there's this famous art exhibit of degenerate art that was considered to be the height of decadence. And so all the modernist authors were put on display in an art exhibit in Berlin. And of course, the irony is that thousands and thousands of people came to look at this degenerate art all the while, you know, oohing and eyeing at how bad it was. So it got pretty good coverage. Probably more people saw it than had seen it before. But But you don't want to get the idea in your head that the Nazis were just kind of old-fashioned, that they were somehow conservatives. And the same thing goes for the fascists in Italy, and also the various quasi-fascists in you know, other places. For one thing, they didn't have any sense of that old sort of moral sensibility. In other words, they're not saying, well, let's go back to the way things were in an old-fashioned sense. The National Socialists were kind of like the pagan hedonists. In other words, there was a distinct anti-clerical, anti-church, and even anti-Christian element to the National Socialist state. And I put that painting at the bottom. That's not a decadent painting. I mean, that's not what the Nazis considered decadent by any means. They liked nudity in their art, and they liked nudity in their film. If you've ever seen that film Olympia by Leni Riefenstahl, it was an explicit sort of Nazi film about the Olympics, the 36 Olympics. And there's a great deal of nudity in that, and great deal of sort of celebration of the natural body. It took a page from the German Lebensphilosophie, if some of you know about that, an earlier movement for health food and sunbathing and all kinds of things. That was part of the you might say the Nazi program, the healthy body and all these things. So when they were thinking about that, they weren't thinking necessarily about any sort of Christian rules or earlier social rule. The Nazis were forward looking, okay? You know, and from the movie that song, "But Tomorrow Belongs to Me," they weren't thinking of going back. They were thinking of going to tomorrow. And they liked a high-tech future. Probably all of you know that it was a government, it was a state and business cooperation, crony capitalism that produced the Volkswagen. Germany had extensive motorization plans. It's a well-known part of the Nazi regime. And so many of the works, even more of the works projects of the Nazis than the works projects of the FDR. And of course, FDR and Hitler, as we'll see again and again, it came to power at exactly the same moment. But even more of the German works projects had to do with motorization, with speeding things up, with high-tech solutions. Indeed, Jeffrey Herf wrote a great book about 25 years ago called Reactionary Modernism. And up to that time, people had sort of thought of the Nazis in the way that a lot of Germans did at the time. Well, they're just kind of old-fashioned. They want to go back to old-timey ways. And it's true that they spoke of, you know, a better time in Germany and all of that. But in fact, they were. If you look into how society worked, there was huge modernization in the sense that more and more women were working in Nazi society. It's not really true that they kept women in the kitchen. Women were doing all kinds of jobs and so forth and so on. They were not for just the old elites. They were for people from all walks of life. I mean, there was a kind of egalitarian aspect to it also. So it's not a movement with just conservative values. And I want to point that out. I think it's really important. As we turn to the kind of official things that were happening in Germany, in other words, that same thing that we talked about last week about making the trains run on time. Well, the German trains, it was Germany, right? They already ran on time. But there's a sense of speed and of the machine and a kind of general newness and acceptance of a new world and all that that came along with the Nazi regime. We need to talk about what the German foreign policy did against the treaty. I mean, it was a in that sense, a revisionist, we call that, that's another use of the word from our use of the word revisionist history, but they wanted to revise the treaty, and so they were revisionists. 1935, Germany withdrew from the League because the Allies had objected to the announcement of German rearmament in 1934. Remember, the Allies had said in the treaty, and this we read pretty carefully when we went over this, they had said, well, in preparation for a world that will be disarmed, we're going to disarm you, Germany, as a part of the Versailles Treaty. And Hitler, when the Germans announced disarmament in 1935 in stages, I mean, he quite explicitly said, well, since the Allies didn't go ahead and disarm in the intervening 14 years, then we're pretty sure they're not going to now. And so we've just got to go with our feeling, and since they really can't stop us now, then we will rearm. There was a plebiscite in the Saarland in 1935. The Allies had called for several plebiscites, of course. We talked about this in the treaty. The Saarland was, people knew nearly, it's 80-85% of just stock Germans. I mean, there's no way that a city like Saarbrücken had, I mean, it just had a few people who could speak French. But the French thought that if they could control the area long enough and hammer away at people, that they could somehow, bring in enough workers and officials and whatnot, and maybe just with school policies and whatnot, teach people French and basically turn Germans into Frenchmen some way. Well, it didn't work. And so they had the plebiscite, and 90-95% of everybody voted for actually 90% voted for the Saarland to return to Germany, and about 5% voted to go to France. So there were 5% of the people who wanted to do that, mostly from the countryside, not from the cities. And about 5% wanted to be independent in some way and just remain as an independent country. So there was a kind of autonomous movement as well. But in any case, the Saarland went back to France, and you see the people cheering in Saarbrücken. I mean, this was cause for jubilation. It wasn't like some sinister thing. It was just German territory going back. It had been kind of administered by the French and the nations. The Franco-Soviet pact was hammered together in 1935, and this just means that the French, who had been quite at odds with the French, who had made friends with every little country along the border, with Poland, with Czechoslovakia, all the new countries, Romania, that it meant that the French were getting really worried about the Germans, and so they took that step of making a military pact of mutual assistance should they be attacked by a third power, meaning Germany. In 1936, we're sort of marching in that direction, right? Hitler adjusts the treaty again by occupying with German military people German territory in the Rhineland. Now, understand, when we say remilitarize the Rhineland, it just means we protect that the Germans were protecting their own soil. Before this, it had been occupied chiefly by French troops and some others. So the reoccupation of the Rhineland just simply meant that German soldiers went in, took over the forts at the border, waited while the French took off, and then occupied everything. They were also quite careful and had orders that if there was any resistance to come back and not remilitarize it. But in any case, that was filling out the rest of the territory of the country that was still occupied from the First World War. Then in 1938, Germany incorporated Austria into the Third Reich, into the territory of Germany. And this is called Anschluss. It just means the connection between the two. And of course, this is really important. It's always seen as this sinister move on the way to war. But please do remember that we spoke about the emergence of Austria as an independent little bitty tiny part of the Austrian Empire, the German-speaking part, at the end of World War One. And frankly, the very first thing that the parliament of this new country did was to vote to be a part of Germany. But the Allies had forbidden that in the treaty, and so Austria had this separate existence. That's why we followed, of course, the fortunes of Austria since then. What is ironic here is that in the politics of the Weimar Republic, what actually allowed the Nazis to get enough of an upper hand to get Hitler into power was that there enough people left the Social Democratic Party and the Catholic Party so that Hitler could overpower everybody with a plurality of votes, something in the 40s percent in 1932-33. What is ironic is that if Austria, although the Allies thought keep Austria separate from Germany so that Germany can't be as strong, if Austria had been there, you may recall that there were two big parties. Nearly everybody, Austria was nearly just a two-party system. The smaller parties played a much more peripheral role than in Germany. So there were these two big parties, and they were basically the Catholic Party and the Socialist Party. So if Austria had been a part of Germany, those votes would have gone onto the sides of the parties that actually did oppose the Nazi Party in the electoral process. So, I mean, who knows? It's hard to say, but it is a kind of irony. Then after Anschluss, Hitler takes the Sudetenland. Now, the Sudetenland belonged to Austria, not Germany, but there were 3.5 million Germans there. They were threatened by the government. They were marginalized, discriminated against these Germans in the Sudetenland by the Czech government. And so when Germany finally got the Allies to decide in an international conference to give that part, that whole almost wholly German part of Czechoslovakia back to Germany, then, it was an international solution, right? I mean, it was not something where the Germans invaded the Sudetenland, but they made an agreement with the Czech government. And the next move gets to be shaky. In other words, I would say just in terms of international justification, the Western newspapers kind of sold the cession of the Sudetenland to Germany as an act of a kind of aggression. It really, in reality, was not. But on the other hand, the second Czech crisis in March 1939, in which Hitler said, we have the Sudetenland, but the Czechs just won't leave us alone, we'll invade. That actually was, that had much less justification in international terms. So all the way we're kind of, revising the treaty, but we get to the Czech part, and we're not revising anything that went before. We're making a new shape of Germany. The only territory left in to revise, really, I mean, there's some little bits and pieces in the West, but the only territory left to revise in terms of making Germany the way it was before the treaty were the lands in Poland. And that's where Hitler turned next, in turning up the steam on Poland and the international city that had been made international, Danzig, and the issues having to do with that German territory that had been taken and given to Poland, called the Corridor to the Sea. Okay, well, let me talk a little bit about Hitler's plans. And first, I want to get out there this idea of Lebensraum. Those of you who took the totalitarians course know all about this, and we've been over it. But I won't go too far afield here. But Hitler had this idea that Germans, the German race, or the Nordic race, or the Aryan race, or however you want to package it, and he changed from time to time, and his followers changed. There's a need for Germans to expand. That if you're going to have a vigorous race, you need to be expanding. This is a little bit like the the thesis of American history about expanding to the West, and it also kind of comes from the same spirit of social Darwinism, you know, that the vigorous white people expanded to the West and drove out the inferior red man and went all the way, sort of a manifest destiny kind of idea. And this was the Lebensraum idea. Hitler also, since he was so explicitly racialist, thought that those basically lesser humans there that the Germans would find in the East would be a great worker bee force to be essentially enslaved. Okay, and so from 1924 onward, Hitler talked pretty specifically about the idea of Lebensraum. So in the sense of plans, he had this overarching plan. But remember, Hitler was a kind of a bohemian guy who really didn't get up until 12 or 1 o'clock in the early afternoon. He was a big idea guy, not so much a detail man. So this is one of the things that's difficult to figure out about his part in the planning, and that is that he said a lot of things. I mean, you know, he would stay up late at night and watch movies until all hours, sit around the table, and he always had his entourage there, and he was always talking to them. They had stenographers listening to these monologues late at night. Everybody else had to get up and go to work. Hitler, he could sleep in. And so he was this very bohemian kind of a guy. And in this context, then he said a lot of things. I mean, we know more about what Hitler said in just sort of, you know, his theoretically off hours than most other people, most other figures in history. The problem is what to make of that, of course. So let me just run through some ideas. In terms of planning, in 1936, Hitler created a famous thing. He had Hermann Göring and some others work together, and they created what was called the four-year plan. And this was a plan which they explicitly said would be a plan to make Germany prepared for war in 4 years. So this was 36, so that's a thought about 1940. The problem is, everybody talks about wars in modern times, you know, and everybody talks about being prepared for war in all kinds of different ways. And people say, well, we got to be ready for war by this or that time. But it doesn't mean they're explicitly saying, well, I am going to go to war in 4 years. Now, we know that Hitler's going to do that. But again, as a historian, you have to look back and say, well, just because they later did this thing that they said they might do, that doesn't mean that that was the only plan. And this is a big problem of history that people kind of project from the past into the future. H.A.P. Taylor is a famous historian, often admired by revisionists because he was a revisionist himself from the left, actually. But A.J.P. Taylor wrote this famous book in 1961 in which he said Hitler, you know, he said things like this all the time, four-year plan, sure, ready for war, sure. I mean, that gives him an excuse to change things in the economy and to have this, you know, people take control over the military and all that. But he said, you know, he was just a normal German politician, kind of an opportunist, no real long-range plans. And in A.J.P. Taylor's view, the war was a mistake on everybody's part. Now, the mainstream of the historical profession really argued against this. I mean, he was in a minority view, but it's certainly true that he's an important part of the it's an important analysis here. And if you read that book, it still reads very, very well, and even in light of all the research that's come out since then. Just before Taylor was the wonderful little book by Burton Klein, Germany's Economic Preparations for War. And that's a great book to read, too. I mean, from an economic standpoint, Klein, who had worked actually with John Kenneth Galbraith on the USS BS, the United States Strategic Bombing Survey. Klein, after the war, wrote this book in which he analyzed the German economy. And he said, well, you know, Hitler may have said he wanted to go to war in 4 years, But if you look at Germany in 1939 or 1940 or 1941, it's not on a total war footing. Here's what the Germans had not mobilized, and here's what the Germans had not mobilized. And they hadn't brought these labor resources that they could have forced people into industry. They hadn't done that. So as Klein pointed out, only in 1942 did they reorient and really bring about a total war economy. About the time that Goebbels made that famous total war speech in Berlin. You know, there's another book that contributes to our ideas here and to a kind of a portrait of the Nazis, and that was a book by Edward N. Peterson, which is a real masterpiece. Peterson was a great historian of Europe and wrote a number of wonderful books, but this was a key in the historiography of studying Nazis and recognized as such by everybody. Peterson wrote in 69, once you go into the workings of the Nazi regime, and not just by the kind of propaganda view of Hitler as this you know, frothing tyrant, what you realize is that Hitler was in essence a kind of a weak administrator. Peterson says, you know, he actually sort of believed in his social Darwinism. And so he would put out competing instructions and to competing agencies, 3, 4, 5 agencies, and let them kind of battle it out. And then when some kind of policy emerged, then he'd say, yeah, I like that agency. I like that man. So he, and in other ways, he shows that there were quite clearly limits to Hitler's power. So that's a great view of this thing, and it actually, I'm kind of lining these folks up here in a way that you get a kind of portrait of Hitler's intentions and his plans. Sebastian Hoffner, a German journalist and an international observer, wrote many wonderful books of history and international affairs and whatnot. He wrote The Meaning of Hitler in 1978. And if you want a great biography of Hitler that's easy to read and not very long, that's, in my mind, the best one. Of course, the big fat biographies are also good. I like those very well. But the Hoffner book is a great place to start with Hitler. And he makes this point that Hitler was, well, he goes back to the kind of gambler or opportunist model of Taylor a little bit. And he also points out that Hitler was like a, you know, there are sports teams that are really good and can really run up the score against a weaker team. But if they encounter anybody on a kind of equal basis, then they don't do so well. Well, Hitler himself was like that. He was good when the opposition was weak and he could shout people down and he could go into a room with the Austrian prime minister and just yell and scream at him and then the guy would leave and do what he wanted, that type of thing. But on the other hand, when Hitler ran into somebody who was, he saw was tough-minded, would say no to him, was not afraid of him, then Hitler didn't like it very well, and he tended to back down. This happened after his interview with Franco in 1940. Hitler had this meeting with Franco to kind of, he had taken over France, Hitler had, and he wanted to kind of pound the table and tell Franco he had to join the war on his side. And Franco, the general, just dressed down the corporal and started, you know, putting him in his place, and Hitler left and told his aides, don't ever set up another meeting with that guy. I don't like him very well. So anyway, you get this picture of a man who is in no sense a statesman. He's got an odd, strange psychology, strange background, very, very, very smart, and has big ideas for planning, but in the execution, there's some very weak kinds of things here. So I think that's the way I would put this. But as this relates to Jews, let me just say this: part of the old revisionist movement was a part that sort of veered into issues related to the final solution to the Jewish problem, as the Nazis called it, and the war against the Jews, and ended up taking a lot of people down this road to say, well, you know, there was no Holocaust. That was just a conspiracy, and so forth and so on. You know, I have to tell you, this Mises didn't think this, and he was a very close observer of things. And on the basis of the evidence, on the basis of what we know absolutely, on the basis of personal friends who have told me their stories, on the basis of all kinds of things, I just have to reject all of that. That kind of thought. I just don't think it's, and I'm not even sure that some of the revisionist historians who have been identified as moving in that direction and whose names have been associated, like Harry Elmer Barnes, have been associated with a kind of, you know, well, there's no acid in the walls at Auschwitz, and therefore there were no gassings. We have a lot of paperwork. We have a lot of physical evidence that witnesses to this. And so I think there were plans for a war against the Jews. On the other hand, I'm certainly of the opinion that Hitler had no clear idea about what he was going to do about the Jews in the 1930s and 35. So in talking about his plans for this, I think he spoke about this. Yes, we removed the Jews from public life. We removed the Jews from Germany. We take care of the Jews, you know, and all of that kind of thing. And only gradually, as he put up these different agencies to work on it, especially within the vast SS kind of homeland type organization, the vast SS police empire, then plans began to percolate. And eventually he would choose the ones who would carry out the plans. I mean, he didn't have to give an order. It was already being ordered from below. So, that's my view of it. It's a more of a less of sort of personal responsibility than of course he was responsible, but it's less personal orders than kind of letting it happen, because he was this sort of hands-off leader. And then it gets to be Himmler, Eichmann, and many others at that level who do the arranging. So that's also about war plans. So there may be questions about that. I will be delighted to talk about that in the wake of this thing. But I am a revisionist, but not that kind of revisionist. I want to talk a little bit about the comparison of these fascist regimes. And let me draw your attention first to a David Gordon article, What You Must Read About the Great Depression, which is just a tremendous set of bibliographical bibliographical citations. And especially from his recommendations, if we're thinking about comparing fascism, the New Deal, Nazism, and so forth, and to some extent even the Stalinist regime, then take a look at John T. Flynn, The Road Ahead, an old classic of the old right movement. And Flynn was this absolutely brilliant critic of the New Deal, and well worth reading. I mean, some surprising things in that book. And then a more recent book by Wolfgang Schivelbusch, an outstanding German writer / philosopher, and the book is called Three New Deals: Reflections on Roosevelt's America, Mussolini's Italy, and Hitler's Germany. And it's a very, very interesting book. And there are other readings in there that David mentions that are all worth taking a look. One thing that Schivelbusch emphasizes is that you get, you know, that obviously these regimes are different. I mean, you know, the New Deal, however much you don't like it, I mean, they didn't kill millions and millions of people. Obviously, there's a clear difference. But on the other hand, many of the policies and many of the parts of the culture of these regimes are actually quite similar. He mentions uh, he's a he's a critic of architecture, among other things, and it's there's some deep analysis in the book of state architecture from the 1930s. It's quite interesting. These are both buildings here, the pictures that you see in this slide, from the 1937 Paris World's Fair. And one is the German pavilion and one is the Soviet pavilion. And they have a strange similarity in their monumental size, the form, the symbolic nature of both the form of the building and the crowning of the top and the fact that the statue sits on the top rather than the bottom. So there's a real similarity here, and you see that in some other kinds of buildings too. Building up on the upper left corner is the new Reichschancellery. And to tell you the truth, it's not, I mean, the picture, of course, makes it look smaller. This is not a good medium to show monumental architecture. But even so, I think in person, even if we saw people better, and there are some people on those steps, they would really seem tiny, so it's big. But I'll have to also say that many of the buildings in Nazi Germany that we think of as being exemplars of Nazi architecture are not that big. They're not that monumental and massive. And the same goes for some in Italy as well. I'd say the Italians built more massive, assertive buildings than the Nazis. But in any case, there is certainly that tendency. And of course, Hitler wanted to create a new capital. He wanted to turn Berlin into a completely rebuilt city of monumental structures, and that would be called Germania, but didn't quite get around to it. There's also use of light in the monumental architecture, and here's Olympia Stadion, the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, built for the 36 Olympics, and here's a rally in that with lights all around. Albert Speer and others learned to use lights to emphasize this. And you can use those lights to emphasize our own National Archives, which was built at almost exactly the same time as a kind of WPA shaped building in Washington. And, you know, I didn't get close-ups of the statuary in front of all these buildings, but there is, if you look at statuary in the monumental style of the 30s, from whether it's the communist regimes or fascist regime, they all have that vacant kind of Constantine, Byzantine look to them that goes along. That's kind of a product of the big state. So I include those here for this reason. So the building on the left is in this kind of city that Mussolini built on the edge of Rome. It's called EUR, the city is, and this building, I forget the name of it, but it's often given as, well, an example of fascist architecture. I've seen it in a lot of documentaries where, you know, a very dramatic announcer is talking about these buildings and they play dangerous sounding music. I'm just not convinced that that the ones in Europe were quite as monumental, quite as out of sync. I mean, this building actually is not quite sinister to me as one might make it look. But in any case, there is this similarity of style, large, repetitive kinds of things. And you can see some of that style reflected in that stadium there, which is not, in fact, a European stadium or a fascist stadium. That's the LSU stadium, built by WPA planners and workers and dedicated in 1937. And there's, at the bottom, that's Harry Hopkins, FDR's famous friend, giving the dedication of that stadium. So you get these similarities in style. And before I go to the Spanish Civil War, I want to go back in. So you also get a similarity in policy. I've already mentioned the public works kinds of things. We see those cropping up in all the European, the fascist regimes, including including Italy, including Germany, very, very similar to Roosevelt. But we also see these in to some extent in Spain in the period before the Spanish Civil War. We also see these this kind of massive building project as a means to end the Depression in France as well. And so as historians, we have to be a little bit careful here and look at all the evidence. But yeah, there are similarities across the board in policy and culture and outlook. And if you study that, you can see that these are really related movements. Okay, well, let's take a look at the Spanish Civil War for a few minutes. This is a kind of forecast of things to come in so many ways, and not just of World War II, but also of the Cold War. So let's look at some notes on the prehistory of the war. Most of us are not very conversant with the history of Spain, so let me just take a couple seconds and catch everybody up. In 1923, the Spanish king, Alfonso III, who was a Bourbon, the Bourbons had been on the throne for many a century, well, two or three centuries. And the political system, remember, Spain was neutral in World War I, but nonetheless had inflated its economy. There was depression. There were all the war problems going on. The Spanish flu was called the Spanish flu because people really noticed it heavily in Spain. They were supplying the Allies in World War II, and a lot of it spread from ships coming in and so forth. So there was the political system was trying to deal with all of these problems and was chaotic, and therefore the generals staged a coup, and their leader, a general whose last name was Primo de Rivera, took over, and with Alfonso's blessing, in the same way that Italy was a fascist dictatorship under the King of Italy, Alfonso the 13th permitted Primo de Rivera to put the Constitution temporarily out of effect and take over as a dictator. Primo himself was a statist, and you know, even early on, 1925, really years before Roosevelt or Mussolini carried out such projects. Well, not before Mussolini. Primo built highways and dams and put the out-of-work people back to work doing all these things. And in all kinds of ways, he nationalized the economy. He stopped free foreign exchange of currencies. Europe was off the gold standard in this gold exchange standard, which caused so much of the economic disruption between the wars, been founded by the Allies and the Americans. And of course, that whole episode we saw of the Americans backing up the British currency and all that. This led to a kind of nationalization of the currency regimes in Europe, and this was part of what he was doing, as well as all these other countries. There were all kinds of internal improvements. Basically, it's tariff or tariff-like regime all along the line, and the system looked pretty much like Mussolini's corporatism. In other words, Primo said, "Well, this state is a special thing. We're here to protect everybody, and so we'll." referee with the different bodies of the nation. Well, Primo died in 1930, and Spain had just recently experienced a depression, and also in the same way that the United States did during the Great Depression, experienced inflation within depression, as Rothbard tells us in a couple of places, but. There was widespread dissatisfaction and some revolt, and this just led Alfonso to say, "Well, the heck with it! I can't rule here. We'll just suspend the monarchy and see what everybody wants to do." And so, essentially, he just said, "I'm going to stop being king." So from 31 to 36, there was this thing called the Spanish Republic, or, I mean, it extended on and fought the war later. So I guess you could say from 31 to 39. And the politics of the Spanish Republic were that they had a very unstable parliamentary system. And the coalitions that kept on forming as a result of this multi-party system, and it was easy to have a multi-party system, but the coalitions that formed to the government first swung to the left, swung to the right, swung back left again, and eventually much of the activity of the parliament was focused on the power of the church, because the church, in league with the big landowners, was prominently opposed to the policies of the left. Well, what happened was that in 1936, a Popular Front government took over. Let me explain. Stalin had put out through the Comintern toward the end of 1934 that European communists were no longer to follow a policy of absolute opposition to the very idea of parliaments. In the communist view, parliaments were a bourgeois plot. They were just simply something to go through the motions so that you would think you weren't being ruled by the greedy capitalist exploiters. Okay? That was the communist view. So the communist view was that the only legitimate thing you could do would be, if you were a communist in a country where you could actually get elected to parliament, would be to get elected and then disrupt everything. Always say no, always shout down speakers you didn't like, always be absent when you were supposed to be there, always turn around in your chair and face the other way when you were supposed to look front, all these ways. So disrupt. And certainly not ever joining any less than communist parties in a government coalition, okay, because you'd be approving the coalition plan. Well, disruption was the rule, and this happened in all countries, so that you could be a communist and in parliament in Germany or France, and they always disrupted. The Nazis, by the way, also frequently disrupted, not quite as often, but the communists always disrupted. Well, Stalin changed the game plan, 35. He was, Hitler's been in power a year and a half, 2 years, and Stalin says, well, this is dangerous. He's got a lot of power. We need to knock down the power of these governments against the Soviet Union in Europe. And he just begins, at this point, Stalin, in the same breath, Stalin begins to brand all of the governments against him, Mussolini and Salazar in Portugal, anybody else. He just calls these fascists generically. So he spreads the term fascist. He takes it from Italy and spreads it to everybody. But he says, you now should cooperate in Popular Front governments against the fascists. All right? So communists began doing this. And there was a Popular Front government in France for a while, 35-36. There were a couple of other Popular Front attempts in other places. But in Spain, the Popular Front government came to power. There weren't actually communists on the cabinet, but they agreed to vote with the ruling coalition. And so once you had this far left coalition of radicals, and then the actual agents of the Comintern were part of the government in essence, then this led to, that's what led to revolt. And the generals revolted with the support of the church, with the support of the old landowners and whatnot, and the support of the large majority of the Spanish peasants too. And this was led by General Francisco Franco, as everybody knows, and he directed the nationalists. He led the nationalist side against the government, which was called the Republican government or the Loyalist government, since that was the existing government. There was brutal fighting, and there were outrages on both sides. The war became internationalized almost at the beginning. The Soviets rushed to the aid of their Comintern befriended government. The Germans and Italians rushed to the aid of the nationalists, the Germans with planes, the Italians, mainly with troops, about 100,000 Italian troops in there. The international brigades were formed, another Comintern project in which they got leftists from all over the world, even leftists who really weren't communists, but they recruited those leftists into the international brigades, and they came and fought on the loyalist side. But there were also international folks from other sides. The Romanians raised, anti-communist Romanians raised a big group. The Portuguese sent a group to fight on the right wing side. You know, various individuals went over and fought on the side. I mean, people from all over the world became engaged in this and volunteered, some for either side. Hemingway famously fought on the loyalist side. George Orwell famously fought on the side of the, of course, on the side of the left. And that's where he had this kind of epiphany about the Soviet regime as it took over and dominated the side of the loyalists. Mexico, by the way, supported the loyalists officially. Portugal, the nationalists. France was pro-republic, but officially neutral. I mean, everybody takes a side. That's the picture. The cost of this war, which ended finally in 1939, were about 500,000 Spaniards dead. People from other countries too. About 450,000 fled the country and ended up interned or on the go somewhere else. Some came back later. About 150,000 civilians were executed during the war and in the aftermath, also by the nationalists. Somewhere between 38,000 and 50,000 civilians were executed during the war by the loyalists. Both sides committed grave atrocities on the other. The numbers are not clear, but it was a very ugly war, and probably the nationalists, being more efficient than the loyalists, killed more people and shot more people in reprisal and shot more POWs and whatnot. Well, this war is a kind of watershed. I mean, it Germany is rearmed and gets to use its new planes. I had a picture of a German plane there. There it is. Something from a plane, a Heinkel plane from the Condor Legion. And the Italians blood their troops, as they said. The Soviets get to see a little warfare they haven't seen that much in a while. And in general, Europe finds itself on a dividing line in a real shooting war. The first big war since the aftermath period of the, at least the first big war in Europe since the aftermath period of the First World War. So there is all that. That's a really important war in here. And I think it's the kind of fire bell in the middle of the night. I mean, you know that something's wrong if you have this huge war going on in Spain and a lot of Europe gets drawn into it, a lot of the world in one way or the other. Well, we've gotten to Europe to a stage in 1937-38 where it's, things are pretty serious. I mean, we've made our way a long way, and we've tried to follow Mises and the Austrians. And so let me just run down the list here. It's an important thing to follow. As everybody knows, Hayek moved before Hitler ever came to power. Hitler was 33, of course. He moved to the London School of Economics in 1931 to avoid Nazi influence and pressure. I mean, remember the Germans tried to take over Austria earlier in 1934. To avoid all that, Mises left for Geneva in 1934, where he was a professor at the Graduate Institute of International Studies. And then in 1940, he moved on to the United States. Wilhelm Röpke, friend of Mises, but a German, left Marburg for Istanbul in 1933 and spent the rest of the, from that time until the end of the war years there. Gottfried Haberler, one of the Mises circle. Röpke had been visitor in the Mises circle as well. Gottfried Haveler moved from the United States in 1936 and taught at Harvard. Fritz Machlup moved permanently in 1934. The philosopher Eric Fugelin fled Vienna in 1938 and wound up at LSU eventually. I don't know how I managed to mention LSU twice in the same lecture, which seems so far away from LSU, but I've managed to do it. I'm not an LSU fan, by the way. Oscar Morgenstern left Vienna in 1938, and there were many others. They were all part of a larger intellectual immigration. And a lot of these people left because they were Jews, and a lot left because they were persecuted for opposing statism and opposing the police state and so forth. Remember, a lot of people ended up in concentration camps in Germany and of course the Greater Reich, which includes all of Austria, and then basically the empire that was spread all around Europe. A lot of people ended up in concentration camps just because they'd written a book about laissez-faire economics, because that was against the doctrine of the regime. And so intellectuals of all kinds, left, right, libertarian, they all got out of Dodge and came to the United States if they could, or went to some other place. And the Mises circle was, in a sense, no different. So essentially, the war ended up exporting the Austrian School of Economics to the United States, which is a very interesting process and kind of an irony in the midst of all this statism and warfare and whatnot. Well, we come to the European allies in the in all this picture of the late 30s, and I want to talk about a couple of points here. We don't go into great detail here, but one thing that I want to emphasize again is that the Europe of the 30s was the Europe of the Genoa regime, of the gold exchange standard, which is really not actually a gold standard. It's a variation of a tool that the old empires had used to manipulate masses of people, and the increasing nationalization of economic policy and cultural policy and political policy of all the countries in Europe, not just the fascist regimes or somebody else. They all built economic walls. And so trade became, for it much, much more than it had been even in the 20s, certainly far more than it had been before World War One. It became the kind of zero-sum game that mainstream economists like to talk about today, that TV commentators like to talk about today. We got to build up our trading block against country X because they're building up their trading block against us, et cetera, et cetera. And so every country instituted exchange controls. Every country instituted really high tariff regimes. Every country instituted all of those tools of the national economy that we now know, and treated this as in a kind of neo-mercantilist dance to the Second World War. And nowhere was this more important than in the German and French competition and British competition for Eastern Europe. From the moment the First World War dust settled, the French were attempting to get in on the ground floor of investments in Poland, in Romania, in Czechoslovakia. In fact, in those countries, the French set up what they called the Little Entente, a number of economic and political and military treaties with those countries that lasted through the interwar period. The British thought, rats, we're behind the French. But they attempted to link up in the spots where the French couldn't get, they attempted to link up with the countries where suitable. I mean, in some cases, the British, for example, didn't really think much of the Polish connection because the Poles were such competitors in the area of coal. But in other areas, they could make some links there. And then eventually Germany comes back in the late 20s and gets into this same market, so that by the 30s, it's a kind of a three-sided competition of these three big powers, where they, under the with the spirit of this national economy of the neo-mercantilism, and they try to dominate in Eastern Europe. All the while, the Soviet Union is, you know, Stalin is sitting by and saying, "What are they doing? I thought they, well, they set these states up as a buffer. I didn't know they were going to use these two to get right on my border." And in the midst of this, then there's the diplomatic policy of appeasement. This was obviously, we all associate this with Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of England, the French Foreign Minister de Lattier, and many others in those governments. And appeasement is a term which comes out of their doctrine, and which is used time and time again in the modern world to beat over the head those of us who are not in favor of constantly going to war and constantly paying back countries for things that they seem to have done to us and whatnot. Let me just spend a couple minutes talking about appeasement here. Chamberlain was, I don't think, a great statesman in any sense of the word, but he had been on the Western Front, and he did understand what modern war was like. He did understand what it was like to see the horrors of the storm of steel that war had become. And he also was a man who, looking back over the last 15, 16, 17 years, thought, you know, we did too much. We had the upper hand over Germany, and we should have backed off. But we didn't. We did too much. We took too much territory. There were too many reparations. We were too insulting with the war guilt clause. We were too ready to take away, to limit the military, all these things. And indeed, Chamberlain had been in favor of even making some overtures about this, even some colonial questions earlier on. But here's how he looked at it. He thought, he said, you know, Hitler is horrible. He's just a horrific guy. And remember, in 1936-37, Hitler he set up some concentration camps, but they were more like a sort of Guantanamo situation for people he didn't like and people who were for political dissidents. That started as early as 1933. Dachau was the first one. But so Hitler was a police state dictator. Chamberlain didn't like him at all. In fact, he said, look, here's the way this goes. Hitler is a sickness, but he's just really the symptom of the sickness. The sickness in Germany is that we went too far, that we undercut their economy, that we took away too much territory that is now not being administered very well by Poland and others, and we backed the victor's side too much. We would have done better to be more circumspect, but we caused a sickness in Germany, and Hitler is the symptom of this one symptom of the sickness. So if we take the proper demands of Germany, the demands that that go back to what we should have done originally anyway, if we go back through these demands and try to appease these proper, you know, properly appeased demands of Germany, then the sickness will go away. In other words, once this happens, how can Hitler, whose main thesis from 1931, 32, 33 onward, his main thesis, not just, and almost his only thesis, is revise the treaty, revise the treaty. If that's his main point, and then you revise the treaty and appease all these points, then what can he go on? The German people will just get rid of him. I mean, some generals will arrest him, and they'll elect, they'll go back to the Constitution, and they'll just keep going. So that was the idea of appeasement. And to tell you the truth, it sounds okay to me. Chamberlain is the object of generation after generation of revision. About every decade, historians change their version of this, and they find more documents, and they make him look way worse, and then they make him look a little bit better, and then they make him look way worse, and they make him look a little bit better. But he wasn't that great, a statesman or anything. And certainly de Laudier wasn't, and all that. But still in all, there is this core of what they were saying as appeasement that I can get on board with pretty well. Now, in the end, they all assumed that Hitler would have to play by certain rules, the rules of more or less sort of honesty, at least in his public statements, things he committed to publicly. They thought, well, okay, he's going to do that because, you know, you can't be an international player and just lie all the time. But it turns out Hitler did lie. I mean, and when it came to the invasion of Czechoslovakia, then Chamberlain said, well, that's it. We can't do this. But by that time, it was too late in the classical sense. It was too late for the British to build up and fight the Germans. One historian has said, you know, actually, Hitler got much stronger after 1938, so that if the British had actually fought in 38, they would have had a better time than fighting him with him than with the war than fighting him beginning in 39. But be that as it may, the appeasement, the blow that a kind of peaceful aiming, peace aiming foreign policy took is a terrible thing. So that you always get beat over the head, whatever happens, you know, if you in the modern U.S., if you don't absolutely go insult the enemy and send in gunboats and Navy SEALs and whatnot, then you're accused of appeasement. Remember, finally, before we go off this slide, that there's depression, there's the war debts that are still owed to the United States, there are imperial problems where abroad the British and the French are hard-pressed to run their huge empires in the world. And all of this makes for a kind of unstable situation in Europe. So let's turn now to the Far East. And I just remind you, I put some of these things down last week, but I just remind you that from 1937, from the Marco Polo Bridge incident, there is an invasion from Manchuria of Japanese army into China. And that it took this horrific, atrocious shape that Chinese were executed and brutalized and whatnot, that the United States had all kinds of boats and ships and military forces in and around China, and that this was in a very dangerous situation. November 38th, the Japanese captured Canton, and this is the start of the Second World War for China. So we say that World War II started in 1931, but that's only for Europe. It really started in 1937 for the Chinese and Japanese. Here's a map that gives us a sense of where the Japanese were. If you do look on this map, and I'll try to, you know, I'm not very good with this pointer, but let me see if I can mark this out. This is the area that the Japanese eventually would hold. In other words, it's this area here that goes from Japan right there across the strait. There's Korea, and we're looking at Manchuria right there. The attack came here, and so we're looking at northern China and eastern China as being in the grip of the Japanese. So if you look for a moment at Singapore down here, at the Netherlands East Indies here, at Australia here, and the Philippines here, you begin to see, if you've never had this map in your mind, you begin to see all the places that the war was fought. And here, of course, New Guinea, here the Solomon Islands and the Gilberts, and this whole kind of circle that this vast area that was fought over by island hopping once the Americans got into the war. So the Japanese were fighting this huge war at the same time then that they in 1941 got into war with the British first and then with the Americans. But there's another conflict that starts up before this. In other words, they're in the midst of this war with China, and it's a genuine war with huge numbers and all that. And the Chinese are, of course, getting help from the West, all the countries that have loaned all this money to China. And what happens here is a little known but very important conflict called they didn't call it a war for certain legal reasons. Neither side wanted this to be called a war. But it's the Soviet-Japanese border conflict. And it happened, I'll just go back one slide here and show. It happened on this border with Mongolia and Manchuria, about there, okay? So it happened in that part of the world. And what happened was, beginning in May 1939, there was a patch of area that the Kwantung Army, the Japanese Army, faced the Soviets, faced the Red Army, but neither, and both claimed a little patch of pasture land on the border, and nobody knew exactly who it belonged to, but both sides kind of claimed it. And they'd had a kind of informal truce there, just nobody went into this area of several square miles, but some Mongolian cavalrymen from the Red Army, and you see those, I don't know that those are the ones, but some went in for forage and tried to find forage for their horses in May 1939, and they took fire from the Japanese army, and the Red Army commander kept on reinforcing them. And there was a several-day battle that came to be called the Nomonhan Incident, because it was near a village called Nomonhan. And eventually the Russians were pushed back. But their fighting continued, and a young brigadier general was sent in to command. He was brand new. You could get rapid advancement in the Soviet army of the late 30s because Stalin had killed much of the higher levels of the officer corps. And this young officer's name was Zhukov, and he was sent in to fight. And this conflict developed into a pretty good-sized battle, the Battle of Khalkhin Gol, of the Khalkhin River, in August 1939. And in fact, the Red Army won. The Soviets won. This was a pretty fateful kind of thing, because in this far off place, 10,000 losses, maybe 15,000, 10,000 dead total, a medium sized battle. But the Japanese decided, we don't think we'll do it. We don't think it's worth it. What could we gain from this? And so this leads to a kind of rapprochement between the Japanese and the Russians. And this leads then to the non-aggression pact between the Japanese and the Russians that will be negotiated during 1940 and eventually solidified in 1941. And that is a pact that they won't go to war with each other. So while the United States is sending lend-lease supplies to the Russians, they are in a pact with the Japanese not to fight them. And that's the condition that goes throughout all of World War II. And the Russians then only decided to go against this pact after we had dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that's an important thing. Well, we have left only to start the war in Europe, and then we're pretty much done. prelude to war is simple. The second Czech crisis, I've already mentioned it. Hitler decides to move in, and he invades what's left of Czechoslovakia after the Sudeten land is gone, which is a law. And it's in two parts, the Czech part and the Slovak part. And Hitler decides to, essentially, the Germans started a pattern of occupying half and then putting half under a friendly government. And they're going to do this in France, and they're going to do this in some other places. And so what they do is to occupy Bohemia and Moravia and make that a protectorate. And then in Slovakia, they get a friendly Slovak leader, a Nazi-leaning Slovak leader to be the president of the country. And so Slovakia then becomes a kind of independent country, as I might add, it is again today. So with that done, and the Allies having done nothing, then they start to look around. What is next is that Hitler begins to apply pressure in the Polish crisis over the corridor in Danzig. And we could go into this in some great detail, but let me say that the Poles weren't blameless in all this at all. The Polish government was hyper-nationalist government. It was a quasi-dictatorship itself. It had its own doctrine of renewal and cleaning. The ruling party of the dictatorship was called the Healthification Party, the Sinatia Party. And so, we're looking at state versus state here. So, and this state was very prickly and never gave, as it were, a sucker an even break. And they were tough. They negotiated to the end. And they always thought, especially after the Czech crisis, because the British then made a declaration, if anybody tries to change the situation, the treaty situation, if anybody tries to revise the treaty with regard to the Polish border, then we'll fight. And the Poles took that to the bank. They said, okay, we can stand up to Hitler all we want. We can refuse to negotiate all we want because the British and French will be in there with us, and they want to trade with us, and there's no reason to think that they won't, help us. So that crisis heats up, and then the Allies, actually to the Poles' consternation, said, well, we've always been standoffish with regard to Stalin, but this is too big to not, kind of test the waters. And so they sent a commission to, by the May, June, I believe, to, we can check it, but they sent that commission to Moscow. And significantly, they didn't send anybody with any power to negotiate. They sent a rear admiral and a middling level British Foreign Department official and some French official, nobody whose name anybody would know. But and this actually told Stalin and Molotov all they needed to know. So eventually Molotov walked in, and after a few days of letting this delegation through appeals, and said, look, here's the question. If a war starts with Hitler, do we get to march across Romania and Poland without asking anybody? We just march across those countries to fight Hitler. Now, technically speaking, they would have needed to do that to fight Hitler. But on the other hand, the West said, well, there they are. They want to take over Romania and Poland. And so these lower level guys said, well, we don't know about that. We'll get back to you on it. And Molotov said, fine. At that point, Stalin and Molotov said, time to talk to the Germans. And so the German foreign minister, Ribbentrop, got together with the Russian foreign minister, Molotov, and they got a big map and drew a line down it and said, let's just divide Europe this way. We get Bessarabia, we get Eastern Poland, we get parts of Finland, we get all that, and you Germans get that, and we'll rectify the populations and do a little ethnic cleansing along the borders, and then it'll be a nice kind of pact. And we'll agree not to attack each other, and we'll agree that we'll swap from Russia raw materials and from Germany weapons and finished materials, and, you know, we'll all be happy. So that was the August 1939 Molotov-Ribbentrop Non-Aggression Pact, and that is going to last up until June 22nd, 1941. So it's an almost two-year thing. The two big totalitarians get together and make that deal. Well, once that's done, there's no reason Hitler can't go to war. And he sees in some ways that this, if you're a gambler, you know the moment to gamble, and he sees this is a good time to gamble. And so we come to the radio tower at Gliwice, which is today called Gliwice, Poland. And that was at that time on the German side of the border. It was right in that Silesian area where they had that hotly disputed plebiscite in 1921. And the Germans had erected in the 20s, about the time that the BBC was getting started and radio stations in the advanced places all over the world, like Fort Worth, which started a radio station in 1922, just a year after the BBC. I just wanted to mention that. But at Gliwice in 23 or 24, they built this radio tower partly right on close to the border so they could beam pro-German propaganda into Western Poland. But in any case, there was this radio tower. It was wooden. That is a wooden structure, and it is, and it's standing today in spite of all of the horror that's rolled over it and past it in the intervening years. That thing still stands today. It's the tallest wooden structure in Europe, the second tallest wooden structure in the world. There's a taller one, I believe, in China. And I forget how tall it is. You can look it up. But it's tall. And it broadcasts all over the place, a highly successful radio station. And since it was associated with the kind of German propaganda, here's what happened. The Germans sent a team of guys in there. They shot all the people in the radio station. They broadcast a message in Polish with words something like, "We've come to liberate the Eastern Germany from the vile Nazis, blah, blah, blah." They made some kind of announcement. They brought a concentration camp prisoner and dressed him up as a Polish partisan, shot him, and then they said, these guys, these German sort of soldier types, said, well, when everybody else got there and they got camera in there, they said, well, these Poles came and tried to take over the radio station. They made this announcement. So it must mean that there's a Polish invasion starting. And this is not the only thing. I got to tell you, this is not the only thing. There are 20 separate little attacks like this all along the border that the Germans did on the night of August, it's the last day of August, on the last day of August, 1939. But this is the one that kind of stuck. If you want to get to the casus belli in this particular war, I mean, that technically what happens here to start the Germans invading, then it's this attack on the radio tower at the radio station at Gliwice. So if you didn't know that before this, now you do. And I think it's a good story. Okay, well, then you see this map of Europe. The Germans invade on September 1st, and the Poles didn't charge with spears and lances and things. I know you've seen the film footage, but that was actually a training film, a training film by some Polish tank guys back in the early 30s. And so the Germans found that film and put it worldwide to show, you know, our armies are so advanced, you know, anybody else is like using lances against us. It's old fashioned. So it's a brilliant piece of propaganda. And it was not actually the case. The Germans took over a huge chunk. And once the coast was clear and the Polish army was pretty thoroughly beaten, September 17th, 1939, the Soviets invaded to keep order in eastern Poland, and they took over everything that you see there with those arrows coming from the west, and I think I can point those out if I, yeah. So the Soviets invaded here. The Soviets also got, as a part of the deal, not quite all of Lithuania, but Estonia and Latvia, a piece of Finland was part of the agreement, a piece of Bessarabia. So a new border was drawn on the west of the on the west of the Soviet Union, and that was a part of the the deal. So the two dictators divided Poland and Europe, and World War II was on. The British and French couldn't get there to help. The next little bit is the phony war, and then a hot war starts up in over the winter in Finland, and World War II is after a fast start, and then a kind of lull is on again. Meanwhile, back in the Far East, we all know, we've seen these numbers before in these states before. By the late 30s, FDR is contemplating blockading Japan. They've adopted plans in case the Japanese should attack without warning. They don't pay much attention to those. Multiple movements of fleets to the Far East and basing the whole fleet in Pearl Harbor in 1939. Strangely, in the United States, the War Plans Division of the United States Army, run by a colonel named George Marshall, was given the job tasked to make only a plan or to concentrate all resources on Europe. As they made these plans, they didn't think much. They were told, you know, don't worry much about the Far East. But clearly the United States was in much more proximity to this Far Eastern part of the war, to the Japanese-Chinese war, than it was to the West. Eventually the United States is going to become more and more involved here. And this takes us beyond 39, and I've managed again to use all my time. And so we're not going to get anywhere within months of Pearl Harbor, so we won't talk about that. But eventually, in 1941, we will freeze Japanese assets and we will have already cut off Japanese oil, and we will have already run false flag operations in different directions. And then there's Roosevelt, who said, I will never send your sons into a foreign war. So I think that's the last slide. I think with that we have done it. I think we have gone as far as we can go and still stay within our topic. And so it's about time to open up the questions anyway. And so let's do that very thing. Let me say, I will search through the two question lines and we can begin I'll try to answer upward and then move downward and then any new questions that you have. Nathan asks, were the civilian deaths in the Spanish Civil War completely political, or was there any religious, ethnic, or other reason? Well, There are all kinds of reasons. I mean, there's partly a political reason, for sure. In other words, the sides killed each other for political reasons. But since especially the forces of the Loyalists were so convinced that the Church was on the other side, that the Catholics so much hated the other side, then they had special fury against the Catholics. And you may have remember in that George Orwell article, he almost makes fun of these reports of Catholic priests, shot to death and nailed up and things like this, because that was thought of as so much a part of it. And I think they probably did. A lot of that was propaganda. I mean, both sides tried to inflate the atrocities of the other. But there's that religious element. Nathan, there was also an ethnic element, that is to say the complicated politics of the Basques and the Catalonians came into the whole mix. I don't have time to really go into that full story, but that was a part of it. There were people who were killed because they were one or the other. There were social reasons too. In other words, there were people who were killed because they were of the wrong class. When, for example, the workers took over in Barcelona, etc., etc. So there's a number of different reasons people got killed. That's the answer to that question. Let me now go up to the other line. That's all about sound. Okay. So, Daniel Vysotsky says, didn't Hinton say the Catholic Church was essential to civilization? I don't know that, Daniel. I've never heard that. That could be true. I might say that at some point, but I don't know it. He was certainly not a practicing Catholic. Kim puts out a joke, Paul Cantor tells a joke about the French ambassador calling in Adolf Ziegler painting in Hitler's office, which was called the Four Elements, the Four Senses. Until there were five senses, he said that was not the case in Hitler's office. Their taste was missing, for sure. Hitler had some of the same ideas as Teddy Roosevelt. He absolutely did, Vangel. That's exactly correct. In other words, his social Darwinist kind of thing. And for those of you who have been in American history courses and heard about the Turner thesis, this whole Lebensraum thing is a very similar kind of thing and concept. And then they both involve violence and vigor, you know. So that's it. Let's see. Was Franco a fascist, or is he labeled that way as he was against the communists and got help from fascist governments? Okay, that's a good question, Tom, and here's my answer to it. Franco was not, they did have this Falange party, which was founded actually by Primo de Rivera's son. And it was a statist party. It was very much fascist. I showed the symbol of that a week or two ago as one of the fascist parties in Europe, the Falange party, like a phalanx, the phalanx party, right? And there was this fascist party, and it was friendly. Certainly it supported the nationalists in the Civil War. But on the other hand, there were times when Franco clearly distanced himself from that party, and there were times when he took a different policy, disappointed in them a lot. And later on, it was not, you know, as time went on and he became stronger, he kind of carried out his own course. So was he a fascist? Well, you know, in a way, that just depends on what your definition is. And, you know, there's one of the reasons that this is difficult is this whole attempt of Stalin to paint every regime as a fascist regime, insofar it's not progressive, right? So this leads to an enormous amount of writing in the in historical circles, anyway, in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, about defining what fascism is. Are there other fascist parties? Is the Romanian Legion of the Archangel Michael a fascist party? Are they fascists in Portugal and all that? All I can say is that that Franco was a nationalist, and he did have nationalist policies. On the other hand, there were some gaps in that, in the same way that there were some gaps in Primo's regime before him. There were some gaps in the fascist policy in Italy, you might say, sometimes. I mean, there were gaps in all of them, but it was certainly a functional dictatorship. But it had come in for ideological reasons, so I don't know. That's not a great answer. I would say, in the end, given this evidence, I would say, Franco, no. not a fascist, but he certainly worked with him. Okay? Let's see. And there's some book citations. Jeremy was on a, and who is this? Is this Brad? Brad Scott says to all participants, Germany was on an economic rebound. Without the war, could they have become Europe's economic power, powerhouse if they had chosen a different course of action? Well, I think so. I mean, if they had chosen, freedom, I mean, I think they would have been perfectly fine. But it was a statist regime. The Germans controlled foreign exchange and engaged in this kind of domineering neo-mercantilism more than anybody else. They were totally manipulating their currency. Many historians think they used this kind of manipulation to push off the effects of the depression in such a dramatic way that Hitler did. And so, yeah, I think they could have been. I mean, at any moment they could have stopped. So yeah, for sure. And then after the war, they did. I mean, after the war, they brought back a man who was Mises' student and friend, Wilhelm Lepke, who influenced others, who then influenced the course of modern Germany and created a kind of, a mostly free market there. Let's see. Yeah, I think in Brad's question, the same one asked after World War One. Yeah, I think if they had adopted freedom, I think they would have would have all been better, for sure. Maggie Gilmore says, in discussing my readings with my dad, he seems to firmly believe that a U.S. involvement in World War II was necessary because the Germans, Soviets, and Japanese had world domination plans that I guess he thinks would have succeeded, to which I argued that the economic systems these countries were running on were not sustainable in the long run and were already failing. Your thoughts? Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. And this is what we've learned generation after generation, that we had to intervene, that it was the good war, that it was the war, for good things. Well, there's a couple of points. A, when we intervened, we didn't intervene against all the aggressive systems. We just intervened on the side of the, against one of the aggressive systems. So we helped a world empire gain, we created a Frankenstein monster, and that was the Soviet Union. In other words, with all the lend-lease and all the help and all of that, and I know they fought a lot of that war by themselves, but on the other hand, we helped create what the Soviet Union became. We fueled that monster. So we did intervene, and we created a dominant world empire rather than the opposite. The other part of it is, was Germany going to become a world empire? And my answer to that is this. I mean, all these points that people try to make about world domination and Hitler, I just can't, for the life of me, see that this was ever in the cards. I cannot think that, considering the extent to which it took the United States and the British and the whole vast Allied side, it took them 3 years of intensive planning and building up things and training and getting so that they could get troops across a 12-mile, 13-mile, 18-mile English Channel, whatever it is, to attack. If it took us all those resources to attack one single island at a time in the Pacific and then fight like mad and just barely hang on. In other words, if amphibious assaults, if projecting power across oceans and across vast steppe lands and across anything else was so tough, was there any chance the Germans were going to come and attack, Pensacola or Port Arthur or San Diego. I mean, you know, it was the Germans could hardly get their navy out into the ocean, much less project power. So the idea of world domination was just not in the cards. Even the Lebensraum idea had to do with the Russian plane. In other words, even if Hitler had won, and even if it went all according to his plans for a thousand-year Reich, where there'd be this kind of advancement across the Russian, the great Russian plain, Pripyat marshes, you know, all the way to the Urals, even if that happened, it wouldn't have had anything to do with the United States, really. So, in a way, that was just kind of thought up. I know that Hitler said tomorrow the whole world, and the Nazi poster said that, but I think they're thinking more in ideological terms. They were never saying they were going to take over the whole world, and there was no chance that they would. Indeed, in the times that the United States has been so dominant and so powerful, there was never a time that the United States, the greatest physical power that has ever existed on the face of the earth, there was no time it could take over the whole world. So I know that's a compelling argument to many people, but in fact, the argument for not entering that war is still a valid one. Now, I'll also say this, and everybody in this class knows it, so I'm sure I'm just kind of summarizing. If we hadn't intervened in World War I, there would have been no need to worry about the World War II, and it seems quite clear to me, and I hope it seems clear to everybody after we've looked at all this material. So, you know, but I know that's not a good enough answer to your father, Maggie, and I've had, you know, a million discussions just like that. But I think it's important to think about the extent to which the Germans weren't even close. They couldn't bomb one single block of American territory. They couldn't do anything to the United States. So anyway, that's what. And if you know, then you get to these conditionals. Well, what would have happened if we hadn't been in? Well, maybe Britain would have negotiated. Well, maybe they should have negotiated. And maybe this would have happened. Maybe that would have happened. Maybe somebody would have leaked out. That's hard to know. But one thing we do know is what did happen, which was about the most horrific, event you can imagine. So anyway, those are my answers to that. That's a great question. Good luck talking to your dad. Ben Jelvisovsky says, Reiko has said that according to Hitler, the two pillars of civilization that had to be protected were the British Empire and the Catholic Church. Well, good. Okay. This fast forwards into the war. This is from Brad. I read the book A Higher Call, which said the majority of German Air Force officers and pilots did not like Hitler or support Hitler. They fought to protect their country, not the Nazi Party. Please comment on the popularity of Hitler among the Germans. He did not get the majority vote. How did he stay in power? Well, he stayed in power, Brad. I mean, he wasn't. Well, here's the thing. That's a great question. Hitler stayed in power because he was able to take over he was taking monopoly on all the physical power at the very beginning. So it's now the summer of 1933. He's only been in power a few months. He talks about the Reichstag fire in March 1933, in February. He's able to take that power, X out all the parties. There is absolutely no political opposition to him. So he just does whatever he wants from 33 onward. There are limits to his power within the bureaucracy, and there are limits to what he can do. That's what Peterson is saying in that book, The Limits of Hitler's Power. But in terms of opposition, there isn't any. And they set up, as I've said, it's like a week after he took over, and they already had opened a camp at Dachau on the grounds of a former munitions plant. His offenses are already there. It's outside Munich. So if there are people who are political dissidents, they just throw them in Dachau. It's not an extermination camp, really. It's just a prisoner camp. It's a concentration camp. So they do that. If people speak out, they get thrown into jail. If they tell anti-Nazi jokes, they get thrown into jail or go to a concentration camp. The Gestapo puts out, gets people on every block. They're called block watchmen. Their job is to report conversations, and if somebody, it seems like they might be disloyal, they get thrown into a concentration camp. So anyway, it's a pretty tight police state from the word go. And then, of course, in the summer of 1934, President dies, Hindenburg dies, Hitler takes all the titles. Then he, as we saw, took over the army, made sure, and in the course of things, a lot of the upper generals, Luftwaffe and Wehrmacht and everybody else, they didn't like him. But at the top of the structure, chief of staff structure, you know, when one of those guys didn't go along, he just got him out of office. I mean, he just often they took the trouble to maneuver. I mean, there are two different chiefs of staff who they accuse of sexual improprieties and move them out of office just so they can put their own Nazi generals in. So that's how they worked from the top. And yes, there were people who didn't like it, but that was hard from the beginning to oppose the regime. Think now about how hard it is for Americans to oppose. Think now how hard it is for any of us to oppose things that we don't like. Think about opposing TSA surgeons at airports. I mean, what can you do? We can all write articles and give talks and talk to our friends and so forth, and we're not even picked up for that. But in the end, that doesn't change anything. We can write to our congressmen, but if they write back, well, I think it's important to the security of our country, then this stays the same. Nobody takes over. Right now, we know that the NSA does illegal, unconstitutional spying on all of us, right? What are you doing? What are you doing? What am I doing? In other words, we can only, you see, we don't like it, but we can't overthrow it. So I think there are a lot of people in Germany. Of course, there are people just like in America who are convinced that there was about to be, you know, a communist overthrow and that the Jews were behind it and the Jews have taken over so much and run people out of business and all that. That was a convincing argument to many elderly, old-timey Germans who, you know, for years and years had heard these little things in their families and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of opposition, but in the end, people just couldn't. They didn't have the guns. The guns were picked up at the beginning, especially the guns in the hands of Jews. I mean, you got to read that new book on the picking up the guns, and the Jews' guns were the ones picked up first. let's see. I hope that sounds plausible to you. Maggie brings up another relative. I'm glad to see your relatives get into this discussion. Maggie, that's great. I'm just joking. My great aunt is from Germany, and her father was begrudgingly drafted into the Nazi army and was definitely not a supporter and suffered enormous emotional trauma during the war and was never the same afterward. Well, absolutely. Well, and, you know, this goes back to Brad's question. You get drafted, you're 17 years old, you just go. You get drafted, you're 17 years old, and the United States, you just go. 18 years old, you just go. I've talked to people who were American troops who were ordered to do kind of dastardly things in the Korean War, in World War II, in Vietnam. And, you know, for the most part, they did them. They didn't know whether they were going to be punished for not doing it. They assumed they would. And in the end, we really are getting into the wartime. The people who opposed Hitler, if we have a World War II course in this Mises context, and I had talked to Lou about this and Danny about this a little bit, so maybe they would like that to happen. But then we will talk a lot about the July 1944 conspiracy against Hitler. And these guys were, you know, a lot of them were army officers. So, yeah, the army was not on his side. A lot of people thought Hitler was this terrible, terrible guy. But what could they do? Your country's at war. You fight for your country. That's, you know, that's what they were thinking. Okay. Yeah, how can a country that cannot get across the English Channel get to us? Yeah. That's a good point, Maggie, by the way. Thank you. And that's a good point, Ben. Gerald Kim says, when looking at the Far East map, it seems safe to say that China was Japan's Soviet Union when considering the size of the nation. Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's a good point. Leslie said, in fact, let me go down to the bottom. I've skipped the, you know, I tend to skip the actual Q&A. I glanced at this question a minute ago about Grover Cleveland lost the election. Did Europe have no tariffs? Oh, yeah, they did have tariffs. They had a high tariff regime. Only in the middle of the 19th century could you say that Europe had low tariffs. After 1860 for France, from sort of more or less the 1830s to the 1880s, 90s for England, the German states all had tariffs throughout the whole time and all that. Yeah, and a big tariff, a huge big tariffs in Bismarck's Germany. So yeah, there was a long tradition of tariffs. Is there anything significant to say about Hitler's peacetime dealings with African and Middle Eastern regimes? Well, Hitler had some plans, certainly, for the Middle East. They weren't very practical. They were just hard to do, and they were carried out mainly by secret agents and spies. He did certainly invite the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the one who had led so many of the riots in opposition to the settlement of Jews by the British in Palestine between wars. He had Zionist Jews. Grand Mufti spent a good bit of the war in Berlin and was made an honorary member of the SS. He had some plan, but to tell you the truth, they were very uncoordinated, and the changing of the war and the way that the Allies then invaded the Middle East and Iraq and Iran and took those over and used them for staging, that all kind of disrupted that. And again, it was hard for, it's all well and good to say, oh, Hitler wanted to go all the way to India where the real Aryans had originally lived. But how was he going to get there? That's the main thing. So yeah, there were plans, but many of Hitler's plans were just daydreams. Rob, I'm going to wait on that question, but don't let me get out of here without answering the FDR question. Evangel said, if the tariffs are so high, then how can the gold standard people talk about a free trade that was booming? Well, I mean, comparatively speaking, it was, there certainly was free trade over large parts of Europe, but it was a fairly brief period. The British didn't have anything like free trade. They had the corn laws and everything. Those were only repealed in the 1830s, right? And so you have to say, well, it's not free trade even in England until the 1830s. And then the liberal unionists come to power and Joseph Chamberlain and all those people. So free trade, I mean, there's partial free trade. Austria's free trade was a lot freer than Britain's. But there were still some tariffs in there. And Germany always, the Prussians always had some tariffs, but not covering everything. Okay? So it's a difficult question. I know everybody says Europe was it was the free trade century, but when you get right down to it, it's a fairly narrow window. Anyway, that's the answer to that I would give to that question. And I'll come back to Pearl Harbor. So let's see. So Leslie says, Hitler's invading Czechoslovakia after ceding the Sudetenland seems to make no strategic sense in retrospect. Hitler could perhaps have gotten more concessions on legitimate German grievances on Danzig and Silesia if he had stayed out of Czechoslovakia. Was his decision to take the rest of Czechoslovakia spur of the moment, or did his generals oppose it? Oh, his generals very much opposed it. In fact, this is what tripped off the great general Ludwig Beck, who had been on the general staff, had been ousted because he was a naysayer, and it's what started him attempting to get the Allies to say no to the, you know, to these things like this. And so, in advance of the attack, he said, "This is insane. This is going to get us into a war, and you know, we're really not ready for a war." So he began as the very first high level opponent to the Nazi regime. And I don't count the communists. The communists always opposed it. So give that to them. Except when Hitler made the non-aggression pact, the communists opposed the Nazi regime and another time. But when Stalin told them to oppose it, they opposed it. But at the high level, influential people, General Beck was the very first conspirator against Hitler, and it came in the advance of this attack. Not many could see that far ahead, but he did, and so he opposed it. I don't think the generals thought it was a good idea. They were just doing what they were told, and I agree with you. I think strategically it was a bad idea, but on the other hand, he could see that Chamberlain and Daladier and all the rest were kind of back on their heels backing up, and he thought, well, this gives me a way to break up this economic domination that the British and French are trying to impose. It gives us a way to open to sell to these people. It gives us a way to buy, and it also kind of semi-surrounds Poland. So I think those were his thoughts. I agree with you. I think he could have done much better by negotiation, but yeah. Okay. Overall, my dad would probably just want to thank you for getting me to talk about the war with him. Great. Excellent. I'll take that too. Let's see. See something, say something. Citing Reiko again, Hitler could stay in power because the Allies insisted that the Kaiser had to go. In Italy, the king dismissed the Mussolini government and he was gone. Yeah, I think you brought that up last week. A Kaiser could do the same once the army made clear they did not like Hitler. Yeah, I suppose so. And Hindenburg could have gotten rid of him too. I mean, as long as Hindenburg didn't die, as long as Hitler didn't become president. But I mean, by the time they had an election for president, it was all the parties were gone. So yeah, I suppose that's true. Although the Nazis were so ready to use violence by that time, and they killed so many of their old conservative opponents along with everybody else, just in the Night of the Long Knives, etc. It's I can imagine ways in which even a Kaiser speaking to Hitler and firing him, that wouldn't have worked. And by the way, the Kaiser in his last year got pretty pro-Nazi there too. So anyway, there's a lot of sides to that question. And that, again, I mean, for historians, that's a what-if question. And I got to tell you, historians don't know what if better than anybody else. I mean, they might know the factors, but it's impossible to know what might have happened. From Rod Huff to all participants, do you see any significance in Swiss neutrality? Switzerland seeming to be the hub of the international banking fraternity, notorious for funding both sides of major wars, the home of the Bank of International Settlements, etc. Yeah, I think that's the policy. They're neutral. They hold all this money. But they were neutral before they held the money. I mean, the Swiss, that's sort of their reason for being. They didn't want to be governed by somebody else. They didn't want the war that these dynasties and states brought on to be in their area. So that's the whole thing between the great Swiss oath in the field of Rutli in 1268 or whenever it happened. They just wanted to be left alone. And the fact that they were up in those high mountains really, really kind of worked like that. I mean, they really did get to be kind of left alone. And so the cantons expanded outward and they could protect all those mountains. And then they built up the cities. Then they built up the banking industry and all that. And then it kind of worked together. So, yeah, in the Second World War, I mean, if you're in the habit of being neutral, why not be neutral? You know, the Turks weren't in the habit of being neutral, but they were neutral and they did very well. I mean, they made it through the war without, you know, without people being murdered or killed or whatever. I mean, and all the neutrals, even though it was a world at war and there was kind of general privation, all the neutrals came out pretty well. So, yeah, I do see that that's significant. I do see that where all sides were storing their money, they didn't want to burst in. The Nazis came very close to, you know, to pressuring the Swiss. They finally, you know, the Swiss at first accepted all the Jewish refugees. A great friend of mine, now dead, was escaped from Vienna, just ahead of a band of guys who was about to pick him up where he worked, and he was able to hang out in Switzerland in an internment camp long enough to get the right kind of passport to get to the Dominican Republic. But but eventually the Swiss began to succumb to some pressure, some Nazi pressure. And there were also Swiss people in the government who kind of sympathized with the Nazis, and they began to push those Jews out, or at least refuse admission to Jews. There's a Swiss movie about that called The Boat is Full, and that's kind of the feeling. That's kind of what they say. Well, you know, we saved a lot of people, but the boat is full. We can't take any more. So anyway, that's a very interesting question. And then we know about the funding and how much of the, you know, like the money from the gold teeth and things like that ended up in Switzerland. So the more we know, the more unpleasant it gets. Cam votes for World War II course. Will there be 5 and 6 week lectures? I mean, the lectures themselves lasting 5 and 6 weeks. That might be fun, kind of a filibuster lecture. 5 and 6. Oh, yeah, yeah, essays, yeah. I will get those out to you. I am sorry I haven't gotten those out yet. I just forgot to do it. I had time to do it. I just forgot to do it. And I will absolutely get those out tomorrow. Tomorrow I will write those questions. Rod Huff, let me go down to the... I'll come back up to Rod's. Let's see. Oh, Nathan has a question. Fine question. How many books in your personal library would get you thrown in the Gulag concentration camp? Favorite one? Oh, well, I don't know. Nathan, golly, that's hard to say. I mean, I guess a lot of them. All the books by Mises, all the books by Rothbard, all the books by Hayek, I suppose. I mean, a lot of them. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. And I don't know what the favorite one would be. But probably they would hate Solzhenitsyn most of all. So all my Solzhenitsyn books would be a surefire ticket. So I guess I'd have to say Gulag Archipelago would be the one that would be actually my ticket, at least my favorite ticket. Okay, Rod Huff says, was France being so woefully unprepared for war a result of nationalizing the armaments industry there? Well, that's a good theory. France was the home of Schneider Creusot, one of the largest, if not the largest, arms manufacturer in the world. That's a big question, Rod, and it's an excellent question. I have no doubt that contributes. It contributes to it. You know, the Maginot Line contributes to it a lot. And that also is a government program, right? Let me say this about the Maginot Line, and this is one point that I didn't really, now that I'm going to start thinking of things over the next days and weeks. Oh, man, I meant to mention that. I meant to deal with that. And the Maginot Line is something that's only come up quickly in a question before this. The Maginot Line was, it had a good heart in the beginning. André Maginot was a French parliamentarian who left his seat went to the front, was at Verdun. He knew what defending a fort was like. He defended them at Verdun. And at Verdun, the French held the Germans off, 1916, right? Maginot was wounded, came back to Parliament, and he made his life's work to get this huge fortress made. So he got it, you know, financed. Some of the funds from reparations were used to build it. With this massive set of forts and interlocking defenses, I mean, huge forts, 5, 6, 7 stories underground, all of that. So it was a massive building project. Partly it was like a WPA project, right? They had to build all this huge thing. So they built it, but they didn't build it far enough. For one thing, they thought that the Belgians would be so committed to building a new army, like the one that, I mean, the Belgians had an army in World War I, but they had just been reorganizing and got defeated in fairly short order. But the French thought the Belgians were on their side. The British would always back the Belgians, and they thought, well, we don't have to worry that much about the Belgian end. So they didn't go quite far enough. And on the other hand, what German officers said after they saw the battle, I mean, if you go into the battle of that part of the Ardennes forest in the Second World War in 1940, what German officers said was, you know, we could never have beaten this line. This would have been impossible to break through, except that some of the French ran away, and that let us break through. So there was a problem there. You know, a great French historian of foreign relations wrote a huge fat book about French foreign policy between the wars. But I think you could apply this more broadly than just foreign policy. The title is La Décadence, Decadence. And I think he just thought that the French were too arrogant. They were too kind of satisfied. They were too relaxed. They were too sure of themselves, and they were just decadent. Okay, they just decided to kind of give up on new ideas and whatnot between the wars. So that's clearly a part of the thing with some people. Here's another factor, and that is that the French countryside, in spite of the crowds jubilating in in August 1914 about the war, and the countryside, people never did. The countryside, people wrote out their wills, because it was peasants who had traditionally been in French armies. And the vast number of Frenchmen who experienced the war, and a bunch of you have watched that great movie, Paths of Glory, in the course of this course. You know what I'm talking about. This was not a war to be happy about or proud of. In other words, the French people, especially the people who were the private soldiers, they're the ones who had died. They're the ones who had been ordered over the top and been murdered by the German guns. So when the French had no enthusiasm whatsoever for this war, there's pretty good reason not to. And I got to say this, in the end, a lot fewer Frenchmen were killed because they did run away, because they just let the Germans occupy as in Czechoslovakia, the Germans occupied half, and then the other half became the Vichy regime, which was a friendly government essentially to the Germans. But at the end of the war, the country was still intact. Actually, the biggest single group of people killed in France in the war at one particular time were the 12,000 Frenchmen that we killed when we bombed every single train station in Normandy in the forefront of the Normandy invasion. So we killed a lot of Frenchmen, 12,000, but, you know, the Germans just didn't kill all that many because they ran away. And it was a chaotic, shall we say it, dishonorable running away. I mean, you get those descriptions of May 1940, June 1940, it's pretty horrible. But in the end, that worked out probably better than if they had fought for the last Frenchman. Okay, let's see. Leslie Webb says, one recent book, I can't remember the name, has argued that Britain was well prepared for war in the 30s because of its armaments industry. You know, I don't know that book, and most historians would not say that. Most of the the mainstream would be that the British were unprepared because of the appeasers, because of numerous other reasons. But in general, they think that the British were not well prepared. And Churchill certainly thought they weren't well prepared, and he thought it was because of Chamberlain's inattentiveness to military preparedness. He thought Churchill thought that the British should have been preparing as of 34-35 for a big war and all that. So I don't know what that book is, but it just shows you historians can make a good case on one side and then on the other. So you have to be really careful looking at those sources and everything. I mean, maybe this guy is perfectly right, but the general opinion here, and I don't have much specific knowledge. I mean, I know what other historians have written, but I've never been into those documents myself and figured that one out. So, okay, let's see. I think you are running out of questions. That's my opinion. There are 15 of us still here in the class, and I believe that you are running out of questions for this course. Does anybody take the challenge? Surely somebody's out there writing. I knew it. Vangel writes, Britain was in such bad shape that it had to license its aircraft building operations in the colonies. Interesting. I remember watching the old McDonnell Douglas sign coming down when Boeing took over the Toronto plant. Under the sign was the old Victory aircraft logo. That's amazing. I would argue that Britain was not prepared. Yeah, I think that's what most people believe. Yeah. And Maggie says, I'm curious what your father has thought of the course. Well, I think he's still listening tonight, so he can reply to that if he wants to. Now he's not a very fast typer, and nor am I, by the way. So I don't fault him for that. But it may take him a minute to respond if he's still there. He may have had to leave early. Who knows? But I do know that he was on earlier. I saw him at the beginning to say that he could hear. Let's see. Any more questions here? I think we're just about done. My dad may weigh in here. But let me just say at the end of the thing that I think it's a really important period. I hope you do too. I have really enjoyed going through all this material. I've enjoyed reading your essays. Vangel asked me when the last essay is going to be posted. That's I'll post the questions tomorrow, and I'll get the others graded up. There is not really a final deadline for the essay. It kind of stretches out. But if it's a couple of weeks from now and you haven't written it, be sure and email me and make sure that I get notified, because it's hard to just continue to check with the course, because the course kind of stays open so that people can, even people who joined late can kind of get in on it and respond on those essays. It'll all come out pretty soon, but I will give you the last two questions for the last two sessions tomorrow, and I'll get on that grading maybe by this coming weekend. So thanks, Tom. I will be glad to see you again in the World War II class. And Brad says thanks for a great class. in on World War II. And my father says, I thought that the course was simply great. Well, that makes me really, really happy. Thank you. This is a little odd, talking to my dad in this way. We usually just talk on the phone. Anyway, the Maggie Gilmore says, I've learned so much in the past 6 weeks. My future reading is just enormous. I'm really excited about it. Also, we live near the National World War I Museum in Kansas City. Oh, I hope you visit. I have heard a lot of good things about that museum. I definitely have to get up there. Then Tom Miller says the Cold War after that. Now, that's an idea, you know. World War II, and then the Cold War. That would be fun. That would be fun. And Vangel says, thank you. Well, thank you very much for being in it. Nathan says, any World War I events coming up with Japan on attending? No, but I will say this, Nathan. It looks like my publisher for the World War I book, and that's Palgrave, is agreeable to a second edition. So I can. We haven't signed on the line yet. I haven't signed a contract yet. But verbally, it looks like I'm going to be putting out a second, new and improved, better edition of the World War I book. Within not too long. So that's come about just this week, actually. So that my event for World War I will be to write some more about it. Thank you, Leslie. It's great to have you in class again. Evangel, yeah, I think a Kindle version would be great. I agree. And I'm going to tell them that. Rod Huff says, Robert Higgs has a book, a series of research articles called Cold War and Depression. Yeah, we could certainly use that. That's an excellent book. Cam says, thanks, Hunt. Oh, at the end of all things here, let me mention this. I certainly wanted to mention this. Cam is such a great guy. He's an accomplished historian himself, and he's fun to work with, and he's got a great sense of humor. I just feel like if I were with him drinking his coffee, it would be good coffee. I don't know that for sure, but I just have that feeling because we've never met in person, never made coffee for each other or anything. But anyway, I do want to thank him publicly. He's always good humored, always very helpful, quick on the draw, and you know that. So thank you, Cam, for your good work here. We've done this but more than once, and I'm looking forward to working again in the future if you're willing. And I also want to thank Danny Sanchez, who is the mastermind behind all these courses in the Mises Academy, and he does a wonderful job. He's an outstanding Austrian scholar himself, and he does a great job, and he's been a good friend. He's been in on this since the earliest days, and I think I taught the second Mises course ever taught, and he's been in on it since then for sure. So anyway, thank you, Danny. You do a great job, and thanks for a good job with this course, and in spite of all the technical problems, making it work out. So thanks very much to both Ken and to Danny. Let's see. high-res photo of the bookshelf. That's a good idea. Maybe I should just go in close and snap some pictures. It would be like a book selfie that you take instead of a bookshelfie. Maybe that's what it should be called, a bookshelfie. Anyway, yeah, Cam, thanks for putting that up there. And Western Front, that's the expensive first edition, but there'll be another one out, and it will be a better book. So anyway, yeah, I like that bookshelf. We'll have to keep that. So anyway, yeah, let's make it $6. Anyway, it's probably, you know, it's Palgrave, and they make expensive books, but maybe I'm trying to convince them to do some things to make that cheaper. So we'll see. We'll see. Anyway, so, oh, is it $6 now? $6 used? Well, that's a bargain. You should get it. Snap those up. Okay, excellent. All right, everybody, good night, and thank you, and all the best to everybody, and hope to see you again. Oh, Cam has just declared it's coffee time, so I think that's all. We can't go past that. So Very good. Thank you. And had a great time. You're a great bunch. And I'll get your essays back to you soon enough. And we'll work on this a little more, and then it will all be done. Okay? Thanks, everybody. Good night.